General Secretary Gorbachev, if you seek peace, if you seek prosperity for the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe, if you seek liberalization, come here to this gate. Mr. Gorbachev, open this gate. Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
That is, of course, President Ronald Reagan, one of his most famous speeches made there in Europe, calling for the fall of the Berlin Wall and ultimately, as time would prove, the fall of the Soviet Union and, for the most part, worldwide communism. We're going to be talking in just a few moments with Missouri Senator Jim Talent, getting his reflections on the presidency of Ronald Reagan here on Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're back with you live here Tuesday, June the 8th. Doug Johnson will join us a little bit later in this hour to talk about a permanent injunction that was issued last week against the enforcement of the ban on partial birth abortion. There were three challenges mounted to this ban on partial birth abortion. And of those three challenges, one made it to a judge. The judge, you remember this judge who said that whether or not babies can feel pain is irrelevant to her judgment? Well, she put a permanent injunction. Jay, we'll be talking about that a little bit later. Pastor Todd Peppercoin joins us in the second part of this first hour to talk about Harry Potter with the newest Harry Potter movie out. And then, in the second hour of the program, we've got open lines for your questions and your comments. In hour three, Senator Kit Bond will be our guest to revisit the presidency of Ronald Reagan, Senator Kit Bond of Missouri, and we'll round off our conversation with Wesley Smith of the Discovery Institute, talking about embryonic stem cell research in light of President Reagan's death. That's the lineup for Issues Etc. today. We start out with Missouri Senator Jim Talent to reflect upon the presidency of Ronald Reagan. Senator Talent, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Thanks, Todd. Appreciate you having me on.
Well, what is the general mood in Washington, D.C., given the fact that tomorrow there will be a full-blown state funeral for President Ronald Reagan?
Well, really, the focus is almost exclusively on President Reagan and the upcoming ceremonies. We're going to have an opportunity today and tomorrow to speak on the Senate floor about personal impressions or otherwise of the president, and then tomorrow evening a memorial service in the rotunda. That one is going to be limited to public officials, members of Congress, and then he's going to lay in state on Thursday, and they're estimating 75,000, 100,000 people are going to be able to see him. And then a funeral on Friday, and so it's going to be a week devoted to remembering him and what he stood for, and his presidency. And it has been given how divided Washington has been over very basic issues, and you're aware of that. You've done a lot of programs on it. It's been a very unified kind of response to the death of this great man.
So as someone who has to work and move and breathe up there, is this a bit of a respite from what we have seen, a very divided Washington, a very divided government?
Yes, I think so. And really it shows not just the power of his personality, which a lot of people are talking about, but the power of his ideas. You know, he believed very strongly in the basic common sense, conservative traditions and values of America. And he stood for them year in and year out, whatever the issue, and he believed in their power. And that I think was the heart of the success of his presidency and is the heart of his appeal now. And it just shows that those traditions are not something that appeal to one party or one group of people. They appeal to everybody if you stand forthrightly for them.
One of the things that had been pointed out here in the last several days is, and it's hard for us to imagine this because the era of talk radio and a broadened media scope has certainly dawned, but President Ronald Reagan was able to communicate with the American people and do a pretty monumental job of convincing people of these ideas you talked about before the era of talk radio. Tell us a little bit about that.
I think one of the he was, no question that he could do that effectively. I think one of the reasons was that President Reagan understood that there were such things as right and wrong. There's good and evil in the world. And it's not like he would stand up and discourse on the dangers of moral relativism, but he just spoke and acted on his basic assumptions and his basic beliefs. So he believed the Soviet Union was motivated by an evil philosophy, a dehumanizing philosophy that read God out of public affairs and out of issues, and that treated people as if they were without value. And so he said the Soviet Union was an evil empire. And he just said it, and he spoke the truth and spoke it forthrightly. He did it also with grace, with respect for people, and it was extremely powerful. And it's a kind of a blueprint for how we ought to act today.
One might get the misimpression from watching the and listening to the coverage after Reagan's death that he was a president made up entirely of personality, of style, rather than of substance. I take it you would probably disagree with that assessment.
Oh, I disagree totally, and you've noticed that, I think, that that those who were his political opponents are preferring, I think, to talk about his personality, his amiability, and that's true. And I think one of his part of his effectiveness, that was part of it, that he spoke with charity for people who disagreed with him, and that's a very important thing to do. But he also was a person with very substantive convictions that he held on to. I mean, he believed in the primacy of private cultural values and traditions. He thought that was more important. Those things were more important than government. He put his faith in what people have built on their own and on our the traditions of our culture, rather than in the government. And in saying that, he was speaking the beliefs of the vast majority of the American people, and he reached out to people in that sense.
He was also, and we heard very early in our conversation here, you may have not been on the line to hear it yet, but of course the famous Mr. Gorbachev, come to this gate, open this gate, tear down this wall speech that he made in Europe before the wall came down. He was willing to go toe-to-toe with world leaders if that was what was necessary.
And not just toe-to-toe with world leaders. He was able to act in a fashion that that certain quarters in his own country believed was naive or unsophisticated. In other words, he, by saying those things, by calling the Soviet Union an evil empire, by challenging Gorbachev to get rid of that wall, which is a symbol of communist oppression, he presented the struggle between the United States and the Soviet Union as what it was, as an existential struggle between one side that believed in the right things and another side that believed in the wrong things. And that was extremely powerful when he did that. And he had a lot of critics at the time in Europe, for example, who thought, well, he's just a cowboy, he's primitive, he doesn't know what he's talking about. But then that wall came down. And it was probably his most important triumph was winning the Cold War. I think he was very much responsible for that, he and Margaret Thatcher. And it was largely, I don't want to say his rhetoric, because it was more than rhetoric, but it was largely his willingness to stand unapologetically for the morals and the values of his civilization that won that war.
We're reflecting on the presidency of Ronald Reagan here in the week of his funeral with Missouri Senator Jim Talent. Senator, Reagan ran initially, and this is, I remember the day, it was very inspiring to me personally, but laying that aside, I remember the speeches in which he would say, government is not the solution, it is often part of the problem.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yet, during his 8 years in office, the popular opinion about the U.S. government among the American people actually went up rather than down. What does that say about the presidency of this man who ran saying, you know, government isn't the answer to all our problems?
Well, the truth is very powerful. He put it in perspective, and we should be careful to do so also. Government is an institution ordained to accomplish certain things. We should not run it down in that sense. Where the government should act, it should act vigorously, and it should act effectively. And Reagan understood that. I mean, a classic example is the way he built up America's defenses. Really, he presented the Soviets with a choice. They could either change or they could try and match the United States in terms of our defensive and military capabilities. And I think history has shown that the leaders of the Soviet Union in the 80s, when they were confronted with that challenge, basically threw in the towel. They said, you know, we can't do that. Our economy won't sustain it. This whole communist enterprise isn't working. He had faith in our faith, And that was a stronger faith than theirs was. And in the end, that's what prevailed. And it was an extremely impressive performance and leadership, and it was impressive because it was sincere. I don't think we should underrate the strength of his personality. When I think of Reagan, I think of as a guy who was smiling. If I just envision Ronald Reagan, I think of a good humor. I think of a person who was optimistic about the future of this country, and I think that was part of it. But it was he was optimistic about the country because he understood it and he believed in it.
So was it of one cloth, this message to the American people about our government, but also the message to people oppressed in the communist world that not only was government not the answer, but government was not God?
Yeah, I don't know if he ever put it that way. But it was underlying a lot of what he said. You know, the idea that we need to have our values and our priorities in the right place. We need to understand where our blessings come from, where our protections come from, and rely on that, rely on the Almighty. I think he said one time, a nation that isn't under God just is a nation that's under. And that goes under is what he was saying, of course. And it's typical of Reagan to present that truth in a witty way, in an upbeat and cheerful way, but and in a powerful way. He wasn't standing up there grimacing. He wasn't negative all the time. He wasn't. He didn't act out of anger or malice or fear. And there's no reason to. I believe in that very strongly. I think what we believe in is what works, and we can present it to people on that basis.
Finally, Senator, we have lived for some time now in the era of living presidents, more living presidents walking among us than ever before. President Nixon died somewhat recently, and now President Reagan. For future presidents, what will the office of the presidency be, having had Ronald Reagan occupy it for 8 years?
Well, I think what Reagan gave the modern presidency is he completed a transformation that I think had begun a little bit earlier, but he understood that part of the job of the presidency was to articulate and to stand for the values of the country. If you listen to President Bush, for example, he will often close his speeches by talking about the importance of charity in private life. He'll say, you know, if you want to make the country better, remember your neighbors who are shut-ins, visit them, help them. Care about the people around you. And I asked President Bush one time if it was deliberate, I mean, what he was trying to do in his speeches. And he said, I just think it's important that in this office we talk about what's important in the country as a whole. It isn't that the government is going to make people do that. It's that the presidency is as Teddy Roosevelt said, is a bully pulpit. And you want to use that to articulate the right values. And President Reagan, I think, understood that quintessentially. And other presidents have used that as a model.
Senator Jim Talent, thank you for being our guest again on Issues Etc.
Thanks, Todd.
Missouri Senator Jim Talent talking about the presidency of Ronald Reagan. Earlier today, I had an opportunity to speak with Doug Johnson, Legislative Director of National Right to Life, based in Washington, D.C., about the issue of this permanent injunction issued last week against the enforcement of the ban on partial birth abortion. I began our interview by asking Doug for his thoughts on the death of Ronald Reagan.
Well, President Reagan, of course, was a great champion of the pro-life cause. He was the first president elected after Roe versus Wade who was pro-life. People forget this, but the Supreme Court legalized abortion in 1973, and of course the pro-life movement struggled and had some successes in Congress for 7 years, but the national news media tended to try to dismiss this as just a flash-in-the-pan sort of phenomena that would soon die out, this resistance to abortion, this trying to overturn Roe versus Wade. And then, lo and behold, the man was elected to the presidency on a forthright, down-the-line pro-life platform, which he then made every effort to carry out during his eight-year presidency. So it really transformed the debate in many ways. It certainly had very profound policy implications, and we very much regret his loss.
What do you make of the former First Lady Nancy Reagan's efforts lately to advocate in favor of embryonic stem cell research with quite a number of lawmakers on Capitol Hill?
Well, of course, we're talking here about the type of research that requires killing human embryos. And that's the type to which we object. That's the type which President Bush is opposed to. We're also talking about the concept of actually creating human embryos in the laboratory, for example, by human cloning techniques for the specific purpose of using them in research or harvesting their parts. We certainly think that all of that violates the respect that we ought to give to members of the human family of our own species. These issues, of course, have developed long after President Reagan left office, so one can only extrapolate what he would have thought about them, but I think you can make some pretty informed extrapolations. During the Reagan administration, the issue did come up about whether to use tissue from aborted babies for medical research supported by the federal government, and the Reagan administration, reflecting the president's pro-life position, opposed that. And indeed, President Reagan often professed his own strong belief that the right to life began at conception. Indeed, in 1988, he issued a formal proclamation, and let me just read a part of a sentence from it. "I, Ronald Reagan, President of the United States of America, by virtue of the authority vested in me by the Constitution and the laws of the United States, do hereby proclaim and declare the unalienable personhood of every American from the moment of conception until natural death," end of quote. That's from a much longer a personhood proclamation that the president issued in 1988. So the notion that President Reagan would have been for research that requires killing human embryos, I think, is one that should be regarded with a high degree of skepticism. Now, nobody's exactly said that, but that's the impression that some people are being left by the news coverage. During Reagan's presidency, it was often reported that Nancy Reagan did not agree with Ronald Reagan's pro-life position on abortion. And once one understands that, then perhaps it's less surprising that she also would not have the problem that we do with research that kills human embryos. She certainly has a right to express her view on that. I do think that she's been misinformed on some of the medical issues, though.
Tuesday last week, U.S. District Judge Phyllis Hamilton issued a permanent injunction against the ban on partial birth abortion. Tell us about that, and what does this injunction mean for that ban on this most heinous form of abortion?
Well, this is not surprising. We're dealing here, of course, with the act of Congress that President Bush signed into law last November that would ban partial birth abortions nationwide. The bill specifically defines this as an abortion in which the baby is delivered outside the body of the mother, and it actually defines how much the baby has to be delivered before the bill's of ban is triggered. It has to be, the baby must be delivered feet first past the baby's belly button, navel is the term in the bill. The head, of course, is kept deliberately lodged still within the uterus, so the whole baby is delivered except for the head, and then the baby's skull is punctured with a sharp surgical instrument, and the brain is removed, the skull collapsed. That's what a partial birth abortion is. Predictably, pro-abortion groups filed three different legal challenges to this act. Predictably, federal judges suspended the enforcement of the act while the legal issues are litigated. And this is just another step in that process. It's not surprising that this particular judge, who had shown her hostility to the bill, to the law, took this action. But there are other judges, a good many other judges are going to be heard from as this case works its way up to the Supreme Court, and we think that's where the final resolution is going to be. The real problem is that we've got five justices on the U.S. Supreme Court who 4 years ago ruled in favor of partial birth abortion. The five justices who are still there said that Roe v. Wade guarantees the right of an abortionist to do a partial birth abortion pretty much whenever in any case he sees fit, and we can only hope that by the time this law gets up to the U.S. Supreme Court that there'll be a shift of at least one vote away from that extreme position.
You mentioned three legal challenges. We've mentioned one here. Give us a lowdown, a brief, on the other two legal challenges to the ban on partial birth abortion.
Well, the case produced the order last week was brought by the Planned Parenthood Federation. There's another case in Nebraska that brought by a number of abortionists. And that case is before the same judge who struck down the earlier Nebraska law, and that decision was upheld by the Supreme Court on a 5-4 vote. So, you know, chances are that judge isn't going to change his mind. The third case is in New York. It was brought by the American Civil Liberties Union on behalf of the National Abortion Federation, which is a league or association of abortion providers. And the judge there has not handled one of these cases before. To outward appearances, seems open-minded. He's explored the various legal issues, including the issue of how painful this would be to the child who's mostly delivered and has his or her head punctured. The Congress specifically, in the law, said that this was one of the considerations, one of the bases on which they were banning this procedure, that it would be excruciatingly painful for these premature infants. We're talking about the fifth and sixth month of development, or even later in some cases. And the medical evidence is that by this point, the baby has got all of the nervous system apparatus to experience excruciating pain when subjected to this type of trauma. The judge who handed down the order last week said that this was irrelevant. But the judge in New York did ask a number of questions of different witnesses about it, and he seemed to be at least giving some consideration to this issue that was one of the reasons Congress banned the procedure.
On that issue of fetal pain, Senator Sam Brownback and Congressman Chris Smith have introduced a bill called the Unborn Child Pain Awareness Act. Tell us about it.
Well, this is a bill introduced on May 20th by these two congressional pro-life champions, and it does declare certain findings of Congress, where Congress would, be, if they pass this, be declaring its judgment on certain matters, and they'd be declaring that the medical evidence is now overwhelming and persuasive that at least by the latter part of the fifth month of pregnancy, if not earlier, perhaps earlier, but at least by that point, the baby does have the nervous system apparatus, the pain receptors, and all of the brain hookups necessary to be susceptible to experience a terrific pain during these traumatic procedures, not only partial birth abortion, but also procedures that dismember the baby, tear the baby limb from limb, and so forth. And so the bill would require that in any abortion done in the United States, past that point, past 20 weeks after fertilization, that the abortionist would have to give the woman certain information specified in the law about the capacity of her unborn child to experience pain. And she would have to sign a form, either saying she wanted to go forward with the abortion and whether or not she was going to accept or refuse drugs that would reduce the pain to the baby. This was just introduced a few weeks ago. It's not been the subject of any legislative activity yet, but we do think it's an important issue. It's an issue that I think that many Americans may be concerned about when they start to realize how strong the evidence is that these procedures that are being done every day in this country on well-developed babies would subject those babies to excruciating pain.
Doug, finally, could the outcome of the Supreme Court's eventual decision on the ban on partial birth abortion, could it hinge upon the presidential elections coming up in November and the outcome of those elections?
Could the partial birth case, did
yes.
you say?
Could the future yes. of the partial birth abortion ban really hang upon that presidential election?
Well, we have Senator John Kerry, who has repeatedly, explicitly promised that he will not consider appointing anybody to the Supreme Court who's not committed in support of Roe v. Wade. And as I've already explained, the Supreme Court has already said that Roe v. Wade means partial birth abortion along with all the rest of it. So if John Kerry is elected, there's no chance in the next 4 years of getting anybody who would be willing to vote to uphold this ban on partial birth abortion. And on the other hand, of course, we have President Bush, who helped push the bill through Congress and eagerly signed it into law, and the Bush administration is aggressively defending it in the courts. So on that issue, as on virtually every other pro-life issue, that I'm aware of, there could hardly be a more stark distinction.
Doug Johnson is Legislative Director for National Right to Life, based in Washington, D.C. Doug, thank you again for joining us.
Thanks for the opportunity.
Folks, if you would like more information on that issue and other issues, you can go to the website for National Right to Life. It's nrlc.org, nrlc.org. Coming up after the break, Pastor Todd Peppercorn joins us to talk about Harry Potter, witches, and Hogwarts and wizards.
Defending life from beginning to end. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Have you ever finished reading a Bible book but then felt frustrated because several of your questions went unanswered? Well, you'll find a helpful resource when studying the Old Testament book of Leviticus with the New Concordia Commentary on Leviticus. It's our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for June. You can find out more about this commentary under the What's New section of our website, issuesetc.org, or call Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040. That's 1-800-325-3040. The Concordia Commentary on Leviticus costs $42.99 plus shipping and handling. How does each chapter of Leviticus find its fulfillment in Jesus Christ? And what was the purpose of the detailed instructions in the so-called divine speeches of Leviticus? Find out with a Concordia Commentary on Leviticus by Dr. John Kleinig. 1-800-325-3040 or issuesetc.org. Our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for June, the Concordia Commentary on Leviticus.
Around the world we'll go for Christ.
Kids get excited about so many things. Now this Global Minute offers these ideas to get them set for global outreach. Answered prayer. Keep a tab on prayer requests from missionaries around the globe and share the answers with your children to boost their faith and show them that God does answer prayer. More ideas for getting kids interested in missions are found on the website www.worldwidekidsclub.com. The Worldwide Kids Club Choir is in its fifth year and has also released a second music CD with songs to teach listeners about missions. Pray for more children to decide that they can impact their world for Christ and make a career out of cross-cultural ministry. Get more information and ideas by visiting the website www.worldwidekidsclub.com. That's worldwidekidsclub.com.
Welcome to the Meyer Minute. A woman I know has the habit of saying, "You know, what we should do is..." and finishes her sentence with whatever the idealism du jour happens to be. As world leaders begin talking about trade issues at their G8 meeting at Sea Island, Georgia, protesters rail against the injustices they see in global capitalism. What we should do is... perhaps. But ideals are impossible for sinners to realize, as anyone working to earn an honest living knows. In the heady days after Christ's resurrection and Pentecost, the first disciples structured an idealistic economy, pooling all their resources, each individual taking as he or she had need. It didn't last. Not unlike G8 protesters, Christians set ourselves up for disappointment when we don't balance heavenly ideals with the finite and sinful realities of life here on earth. Christ in us is the balance. Hebrews says, "For the joy that was set before him, he endured the cross, despising the shame, and is seated at the right hand of the throne of God." Daydreamers will end up pining, shoulda, woulda, coulda. Christ in us is idealism incarnate, not in protest, but in the small, helpful good works you'll do today for others and toward our common good.
On the next Midday Living Jubilee, midweek on AM 850 KFUO at 11:05, join me, Diane Summers. We'll be talking a little bit with Kay Meyer of Family Shield on their open house coming up this Sunday, also on an old-time rock and roll celebration coming up. Mary Hunt joins us, founder and publisher of Cheapskate Monthly and author of Debt-Proof Your Marriage, How to Achieve Financial Harmony. It begins at 11:05, Living Jubilee on AM 850 KFUO.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Here in the middle of the first hour, we're going to pick up a conversation about Harry Potter. We haven't talked about Harry Potter in a while, and I remember there was a time, now this was not a very long time, when I heard over and over again, Harry Potter, Harry Potter, and I was thinking to myself, what is everybody going on about? Well, finally, of course, I got the books and I read through them, and my daughter was interested in reading the books. Now the movies have all come out, and there are more to come out, of course, both books and movies. Maybe you're one of those who've heard this, Harry Potter, and said, what in the world is everybody all excited about? Well, this last weekend, of course, the latest movie debuted, and my daughter told me, after having seen it, best one ever. She said it's also made from the best book of the series ever. So, Of course, I will have to see that as well. We're going to talk about Harry Potter, whether or not Christians should read the books or go see the films, with Pastor Todd Peppercorn here for the remainder of this first hour of Issues, Etc. In the second hour of the program, open lines for your questions and your comments. We've talked quite a bit about President Ronald Reagan. Many of those who we've talked to, and of course you've heard other interviews as well with those who knew him, have talked about this man's deep personal faith, a private faith, a man who is a Presbyterian, President Ronald Reagan, who was renowned for making references to God. He popularized, as part of kind of standard boilerplate presidential speechmaking, the word God bless America. God bless you and God bless America. It's become standard for every president since his time. But he was also renowned for very, very seldom attending church. What do you make of that? A man who has been hailed, I've heard recently on Christian radio, hailed as something of a patron saint of American Christianity, who very, very few times darkened the door of an actual church. That's a question for you during open lines in the second hour of Issues, Etc. Pastor Todd Peppercorn is our guest for this 25 minutes. He's pastor of Messiah Lutheran Church in Kenosha, Wisconsin. He's editor-in-chief of the Lutheran Youth magazine that I'll talk about a little bit later, called Higher Things. Pastor Peppercorn, welcome back to Issues, Etc.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
For those who have heard the name Harry Potter and know something, that there's some sort of phenomenon out there that goes by this name, but do not know about the books or haven't read the books or seen the films, give us a brief introduction.
Okay. Harry Potter is a now, I believe, five-volume series written by an English author named J.K. Rowling. First one must have come out about five, maybe 6 years ago, something like that. It recounts the story of a young boy whose parents were murdered by an evil wizard, and who then ended up living with his aunt and uncle, who are kind of, they're just not the best parents in the world, let's put it that way. And Potter doesn't realize that he is a wizard. And so the first book begins with him discovering that he has these powers, and that he is set to go to a school called the Hogwarts School. And basically the five books recount this story of Harry Potter, this young man, and his learning what it means to be a wizard. And he encounters all kinds of good, bad, and ugly characters along the way. That's the short version.
So as a premise of this series of novels, now films, that is still unfolding from the pen of J.K. Rowling, there is it's a magical world. It is a world where magic is, at least for Harry Potter and his young wizard friends, a ordinary part of life?
That's right. It's one of the interesting things I think about the books is that magic is viewed as basically neutral. It's almost like another form of science, super science. That if you're in the know, if you're a part of the group that recognize this, then you're in. But that magic in and of itself doesn't have any moral value one way or the other. So there are good wizards and there are bad wizards, just like there are good people and there are bad people.
So the power of magic in these novels and films can be used, depending upon the person using them, for either good or for ill, but magic itself has no moral impact.
That's the premise of the books. That's right.
Okay, let's evaluate that at the beginning, because that has been the objection of many Christians to both reading the novels and watching the films. Is that necessarily something of which Christians cannot, and then perhaps should not, expose themselves? This notion that magic is neither good nor evil.
Well, that's certainly a good question. A part of what makes that what makes this interesting is that these are books. It's a part of a genre that you could call fantasy. The books are not intending to depict real life, and they make no presumptions of doing so. I think a big part of the Christians' angst over
over this, and I would suggest over any kind of fiction, this isn't even limited to fantasy, is that if you're talking about fiction, you're talking about the realm of imagination. You're talking about things that are not true. And so whether I'm talking about magic or whether I'm talking about making up a story about my dog Spot, the premise is still going to be that something is not true. So I'm making it up. Now that's one level of that question. Another level of the question is very obviously that Christians do not practice magic or sorcery or any kind of satanic arts, as the Catechism says. We should fear and love God so we do not curse, swear, use satanic arts, lie, or deceive by his name, but call upon it in every trouble, pray, praise, and give thanks. So if we're talking about actually using magic, then certainly Christians should have no part of it whatsoever. What I wonder about myself, well, I don't wonder, I certainly have an opinion on it, is I don't think that Christians reading fantasy or going to movies that depict fiction is contrary, per se, to the Christian faith.
So let's see if we can try a crude comparison here.
Okay.
The next Spider-Man movie is about to break here.
Mm-hmm.
And it is obviously fantasy. Mm-hmm. A boy, you know, boy becomes Spider-Man, able to spin webs and exercise extraordinary strength and climb walls.
Right.
Does not happen. It's the product of someone's imagination. That's part of the fun of watching this thing.
Sure.
If it were said Magic Spider-Man, it would probably be no more harmful, at least in that sense, than just here's Spider-Man.
Right. I mean, the premise of the Spider-Man series is this, you know, he's bitten by this super spider that's genetically altered. As far as we know, that's not possible. But maybe it is. I don't know. Maybe I don't want to know. But I would suggest that at that level, we're talking about the same thing. But what is underneath that, and this is what I think we as Christians really need to be talking about when we're talking about Harry Potter or when we're talking about The Lord of the Rings or any kind of fantasy, is what is underneath the story? Because I don't think that the magic is the point of the story. That's one of the tools that the author uses to develop character and plot. That's not finally the point, or at least it shouldn't be the point. The question is, what are the underlying values that these characters are trying to uphold? What kind of world are they trying to present? And now that's where you're really, as Christians, I think, getting into some interesting questions about Harry Potter.
There are several other things, and this is certainly not unique to the Harry Potter series of novels or the films, but if one reads them, I've read all of them carefully, it is a godless world. I don't mean godless in the pejorative sense, but a world absent a deity that he lives in, isn't it?
It is completely secular. No question about it. There's no God plays no part in it whatsoever. And that is one of the potential dangers to the series, is that it does present a worldview where there's not even any kind of higher power that's ever discussed, far less actually talking about the God who reveals himself in Holy Scripture. So that is certainly something for us as Christians to be conscious of, that when we're looking at this, it is an incomplete picture of the way that God has created the world, and obviously one author's kind of skewed picture in some other ways. So yes, that is something we should be concerned about. On the other hand, though, I think that we have to ask ourselves the question: what is the purpose that the author is trying to portray? And is that purpose something, even if it's not everything, is it something that we as Christians can embrace and find some benefit to? For instance, one of the character traits that's upheld throughout all of the novels is friendship and loyalty to your friends above all else. Well, that's a pretty good character trait for us to uphold. It's not everything, but they're not upholding betrayal and murder and lying. So there are things that we can hold up to, but it's certainly not going to be everything.
And while magic is portrayed as morally and spiritually neutral in the Potter series, there is a clear delineation between the good characters and the bad characters, isn't there?
That's right. And that's one of the things that I think we as Christians can look at and say, this may have some benefit for our children, that there are good guys and there are bad guys, and that even more, that sometimes the good guys aren't always that good, and sometimes the bad guys aren't the ones you really thought, which frankly is pretty true to real life. So we can learn some things about right and wrong. We can learn about truth. We can learn about loyalty. We can learn about friendship. But there are other things that we may not, things that the books may teach, which are not helpful. For instance, I don't think that they give a very good picture of, or at least not a consistent picture of authority. For instance, the teachers are evaluated as being good or bad simply based on either their personality or on how interesting of a teacher they are. So the kids sometimes, I think, are justified in the books in doing things that obviously they shouldn't be doing on the basis of who the teacher is.
That was one of my concerns, Todd, and it really had to do with not just authority, but it is a children's novel, and sometimes you find this in children's novels, the children seem to be the ones who inevitably kind of see the hammer about to fall. The adults are either willfully ignorant or passively ignorant. Very few of them, even the one that seems to kind of have this omnipotence authority over the whole situation, the headmaster of Hogwarts School for Wizardry and Witchcraft, Dumbledore, sometimes seems kind of indisposed to do anything about bad things that are happening.
He's often disconnected, and I kind of think that that's one of the other underlying things behind this series that that does make me a little nervous, is that it kind of falls into the very modern notion of learning is simply self-discovery, that the students are the ones that are going to be driving the learning, not the teachers. And if the students are simply able to discover things as they will, they're more capable of finding out what's right than their teachers are at giving them. Well, that's a pretty messed up worldview, and that is a cause for concern, no question about it. But the whole way that adults are portrayed, I think, is probably more of a reflection of how middle school students think of adults, and maybe that's the problem. This series is really geared toward about 11 to 14 years old, and so the worldview that it presents regarding adults and younger people is meant to resonate with a 12-year-old who's just kind of discovering their identity. They're just trying to, they're just learning that they can actually rebel against their parents and against teachers and other authorities. And that's one of the areas I'm not sure if the books are really all that helpful, is I think that they may kind of endorse that, the wrong side of that struggle.
What about, and this is more a problem in the latter parts of the series and in the films than in the earlier novels in the series, the Harry Potter series, what about the violence?
I guess the short version for me is that's gonna really depend on who's seeing it. I don't think that a child under about 8 should see any of the Harry Potter movies. But even that is going to be somewhat of a subjective judgment. There is a very strong sense of evil that, especially by the time you get to the fourth book, really becomes very dark. And I have a hard time imagining a 7 or 8 year old being able to find any enjoyment out of that. I think it would just really frighten them. So that's going to be a question of age, and that's going to be a combination of where the child sits, but also the parents and how comfortable they are exposing their children to that kind of violence. I don't think that it's anything compared to what you find on, or anything, certainly nothing worse than what you're going to find on most network television. But that's hardly an endorsement.
We're talking with Pastor Todd Peppercorn, pastor of Messiah Lutheran Church in Kenosha, Wisconsin, and editor-in-chief of the Lutheran Youth magazine titled Higher Things, about Harry Potter. Feel free to join us if you'd like to, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. The other concern I have, and I'd like your thoughts on this, Pastor, is that, as you just mentioned, the novels kind of become increasingly dark. Dark in their outlook, dark in kind of the mood of the characters. The violence does become more prominent, and I'm a little concerned about the next one, and then the next one, because we do have, at least at last count, 2 more books to go if they're going to cover all 7 years of Harry's Hogwarts experience. I'm a little concerned about them getting too dark for children, and they are intended for children.
I agree. It's something that's really a cause for concern, and it really gets down to what is the target reading group for this. If the target reading group for this is 10 or 11, 12 years old, something like that, then it is something that I'm certainly concerned with. The fourth book really became very dark by the end, and the next one was in some ways worse. So I think that's going to probably be a wait and see issue for us as Christians, and I wish there was a clearer answer for that. But I guess I'm not opposed, as a matter of principle, to having children that age seeing violence. I don't consider that to be wrong in and of itself. The question is, what kind of violence is it? Is it serving a moral purpose? Is it going to reinforce teaching truth and right and wrong, or is it simply glorifying death in some fashion? Because if that's the case, then obviously it's not serving any good purpose.
So on that issue of the violence of the darkness of the novels, and if we could add to that, of course, the other concerns that you have raised here, is this an issue upon which, in your opinion, Christian parents, and that's what we're talking about here, we talk about what our children consume by way of film and books, and other Christians can disagree in good faith about whether or not these things are good entertainment, because essentially that's what they're intended to be for us or our kids?
I believe that Christians of goodwill can disagree, even very strongly on this series, but that's because I believe that this falls in the realm of the freedom and good judgment of Christian parents. What would concern me would be using the basic argument that because it contains magic, because that's kind of a part of the premise of the series, that therefore Christians should have no part in it.
Why would that concern you?
Because I think it's a false distinction. If we say we're not going to use this because this is involving magic, even though it's fiction, even though it's clearly portraying something that's untrue, but we're not going to use this because it portrays magic, I'm not sure if you could make a distinction between Harry Potter and Lord of the Rings, or Dora the Explorer, or Stanley, or any other program that presents things that are unreal. I mean, you could argue that a 2-year-old program like Stanley, because he goes into this magic book, is portraying witchcraft. Now, that's nonsense. That's just I just don't buy that at all. But I think it would be pretty inconsistent to argue that one is wrong, but the other one's okay.
And what about those who say, look, I don't need to know about this, My kids aren't going to read it. I'm not going to read it. Or on the other hand, the parent who says, you know, I'm going to buy them for my kids because they're obviously popular and I don't feel the need to peruse them before Junior picks up these five novels.
Well, once again, that's going to be the realm of the judgment of the parents. Personally, I think that that would be a mistake. I think that any parent that's going to have their middle school children read these novels needs to read them. I think that they owe it to themselves and they owe it to their children to do so. I suppose it's not absolutely necessary. This is a part of the reason why there are reviews out there, trustworthy reviews that do things on these books and elsewhere, so that parents can look at it and can make an evaluation. If I trust the person that did this review, then I know I have something to go on. But that is pretty inconsistent, frankly, for Christian parents, certainly for Lutherans. Where are you going to go to find a good, sober, careful worldview for all of the things that your children are going to be exposed to?
Pastor Todd Peppercorn, thank you for being our guest on Issues Etc.
Thank you. I've enjoyed it.
Pastor Todd Peppercorn is pastor of Messiah Lutheran Church in Kenosha, Wisconsin. He is also editor-in-chief of the Lutheran youth magazine titled Higher Things. Now, this everybody talks about youth ministry and reaching the younger people and keeping them in church. If you're really serious about this, folks, this is the kind of magazine that you get a subscription for every youth-aged person in your congregation. And it's worth every penny. It's called Higher Things. You can find out more about it by going to our website, issuesetc.org. Click on the Links with Regular Guests link. Scroll down. You're going to find Pastor Todd Peppercorn and Higher Things and their website. Get a pen and a piece of paper ready during this break. When we come back, I'm going to give you the mailing address for Higher Things magazine. Right after this break, the mailing address for Higher Things magazine. When we come back, we've got open lines for your questions and your comments. We've been talking a lot about Ronald Reagan. We continue to do so, and you will hear about it all this week, I'm sure, until he is laid to rest. People have said Ronald Reagan was a man of deep personal faith. No reason to doubt that. People have said he was a man who returned America, God to America. I don't know what that means exactly. He was renowned for not going to church. As president, he was renowned for not going to church. Now, there might be a reason for that, but I want to know what you think about that. It's not that he never went to church, but not very often during his presidency. He wasn't a churchgoer. Does this concern you about the late President Ronald Reagan? We'll talk about that during Open Lines. Call during this break right after this.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.